So we're going to do something a little different this morning. If you'll get out your bulletin, I want to call your attention to the collect that we read together just before we began to sing in worship. And we're going to let a phrase from that collect guide our observations of the lessons or the readings this morning. I want to draw your attention, I don't have it in front of me, it's the third or fourth line there, where the collect asks that our unruly wills and sinful affections would be brought into line. And as we come near the end of a Lent, of this time of little fastings and pausings and quietings, if you've been doing that, I don't think it would take a big prophet to say you're probably discovering some things about yourself that are less than pleasant. And you'll notice that the readings this morning all kind of shout out new life, resurrection, God can do it, out of death and unruliness and hardship, God does his thing. And that's the main idea I want to draw your attention to this morning. Because while we begin with bring into order our unruly wills and sinful affections, we really end with where Lent is pointing in resurrection to give us the grace, you see the next phrase or two on, give us grace to love what you command and to desire what you promise. And that's the kind of resurrection life that we're talking about. Well, what is a will? On one level, it's not too much to say that your will equals you. That the one thing that makes you distinct in all of the cosmos is your capacity to direct yourself. Now, God's given you a body and able to do that. So you have a will that no one can see. Sometimes in the Bible, it's talked about as heart or spirit. It's the unseen part of you, but it's the most you. Meaning, think of this, someday you will have a new body. We just finished reading the gospel. You are never going to die. Did you catch that? You are actually never going to die. But you're going to have a different sort of body. You're going to go through some sort of translation experience. But you will still be recognized. We will still know you because you are not your body. You can't be located anywhere in your body. Like if I took a scalpel and opened you up from your throat, you know, down to your belly button and opened you up, would I find you in there somewhere? Where are you in there? Or am I cutting on the wrong place? Do I have to open your head? Would I find you in your head? Or like, are you inside your skull? Is that where you are? No, you're not your brain. Your brain is just a sophisticated piece of meat. You're not your brain, you're not your heart, you're not your liver. You are a never-ceasing spiritual being. You're a soul, you're a will, meaning heart, spirit. And so when our collect this morning asks us to bring into line our unruly wills, he's really asking for something very deep. Because it's in our wills where we decide what we do with our bodies. So think James. What a fire this little piece of meat called a tongue can set. Think of the sin that can be committed with our hands. Well, those are only expressions of this will. And what a prayer like this, Lord, bring our unruly wills and sinful affections into a line. What a prayer like this says to us is that we are not victims, but rather we are creators. So if you just think of a really simple example of this, let's say you hurt someone in anger or with gossip. And in Lent, you discover it and you think, well, I don't want to do that anymore. Well, then you have to change your thoughts and feelings. Because when you react and hurt somebody in anger, you're a creator of that. You're not a victim of it. And it comes out of our deep wills. Now, I always say this because I really mean it. You will never hear me making political statements in sermons. This is not a political statement. It's a human statement. I don't remember how long ago it was. I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years ago. I lose track of time. Dan Rather was interviewing Bill Clinton. And Dan was the first person to really ask Bill the toughest questions of all the questions that could have been asked about Monica Lewinsky. Rather said to Clinton, "Why?" And you can look it up. Bill said, "For the worst of all possible reasons, because I could." And if Bill were sitting here this morning, I'd just say, "Bill, I believe you mean that, but that is not why you did it. You did it because your heart is full of lust. It is full of disordered desire. So much so that you couldn't stand the sight of a kid's thong. Your will is so disordered, it's so unruly, your affections are so out of control. It's not that because you could. There are lots of things within the range of our effective will. There are a lot of things that could. But if I was doing spiritual direction with Bill, I'd say, Bill, you know that cobra that escaped from the Bronx Zoo recently? Go with me here, Bill. It's right at your cheek and flares. And Monica walks by, and she flashes you her thong. Evidently, this is what happened. Would you do it, Bill? That cobra's right at your cheek. Take the first step, and whap! Would you do it? No, it's not because you could. It's because you desired it so much that you couldn't control yourself. You have an unruly will. The basic part of what makes you human is out of control. So much so that you're willing to risk everything you'd set your life goal on. So these unruly wills, these affections, if we're going to get at them, what we're really talking about is the renovation of our hearts. And I suppose that comes to mind because I had a fun day on Wednesday. I got to spend a half a day with my really, really great, good friend who I treasure, Dallas Willard. So I just have to confess, I have Dallas on my mind this morning. So renovation of the heart comes easy to mind. So here's the way this really works. Most temptations to act on an unruly heart, they come from this one underlying fundamental thought. And I guess if you don't hear anything else I say this morning, I would if I don't say anything much more in the next 10 years, if you get this, you're okay. This is what really is going on. This is what's the thought process of 99% of the people when there's a temptation to act on an unruly heart. Here's what's really going on. If I don't do this, I'm going to miss out on something really big, something really fulfilling, something really important. If I don't do this, I'm going to miss out. So if I don't react in anger and manipulate this person, I'm going to miss out on controlling my life. If I don't act out on some sort of sexual behavior, well, then I'm going to miss out on fulfilling something in me that seems really me. Okay, now we're connecting. Why does it seem like that I have to have this? It feels like if I don't have this, that I'm somehow not being true to myself. It's because you're not being true to yourself when yourself is fundamentally an unruly will. So now the choice is before you. You say, I'm an unruly will, and if I don't do what my unruly will wants, I'm not keeping it real. And this pervades our society. Again, if I were sitting with Bill doing spiritual direction, I'd say, Bill, Monica's name's Chelsea. You want some CEO doing that to your daughter? What if he just had to? And he kind of felt like if he didn't do it, he wasn't keeping it real. And this is what marks our society today. Keeping it real is a much higher value than transforming what's an unruly desire. But to do that, one has to work on their thoughts and feelings. Because as I've said to you before, your will does not sit alone. Because though you are most fundamentally a will, you're not merely a will. You also have a social self, which means peer pressure. And you have thoughts, and you have desires. And these thoughts and the desires are like Washington lobbyists. And they're always lobbying your will. This is where we get these sort of ideas and these feelings that if I don't do this, I'm going to miss out on something that's so important, I really have to do it. But here is the big, beautiful truth. Enormous, beautiful truth. In the kingdom of God, you never have to do wrong to be safe. You never have to do wrong to be okay. You never have to do wrong to be fulfilled. You don't have to. And of course, this is what Jesus is getting at when he says, seek first the kingdom of God. And all these other things will be given to you as well. See, when Jesus says stuff like that, he knows he's talking to souls who are wills. That is to say, he's talking to people who have the ability to do or to not do, to do or to restrain themselves, to consent to something or to not consent to it. He knows that we are essentially, the most essential part of us is our wills, our heart, our spirit. And they're very precious, this internal part of us, it's very precious. But it's also a problem. And this will be obvious as soon as I say about it, as soon as I say it. How much of your life is spent trying to deal with conflict within your own will? Think about it. How much time do you have to spend, mental, emotional, energy spending, just trying to control your own will? Because your own will is divided. Not to mention what this does to society. Because if thoughts and feelings and will, our heart and spirit, is essentially us and our character, and if us together, that is essentially our society, then I love this one quote I've got to give you from Dallas, where in Renovation of the Heart, Dallas says, civilization is a smoldering heap of violence, constantly on the verge of bursting into flame. Civilization is a smoldering heap of violence, constantly on the verge of bursting into flame. That is the true picture of the fallen human will. And of course, it's true. All you have to do is get out your smartphone right now and, you know, go to Yahoo News or MSN News or something. Here's what you'll find. Political showdowns in America. Wills at odds against each other in Libya, in Iran. Palestinians and Jews in the Gaza Strip. Uprising again in Egypt. The Ivory Coast is out of control. Irish Catholics and Protestants have never figured it out. On our border right now, there's a huge drug war going on both sides. In my view, here's what's happened in my lifetime, and maybe it's been happening longer, but it used to be that a focused and coherent will, that is to say, an integrated person, used to be seen as a good thing. But now that seems boring. It seems sort of Puritan. It seems like, you know, from another era, you know, like, I don't know, you don't hear people talking about that anymore. Now what the big deal is freedom. Freedom for whatever feels good and satisfies me at that time. So the idea is I can reinvent myself. Now, this is kind of old, shows you how fast things change, but it was only 2 or 3 years ago when MySpace was the big deal, not Facebook. And if you go back and you look at some of the early commentary about MySpace, is that right? Yeah, MySpace. The early commentary, especially when it came to junior high and high school kids and even younger college kids, all the worried sort of social commentary was that these kids are reinventing themselves on MySpace. They're putting profiles out there. And it was a classic way for somebody to intentionally fragment themselves. And you just think about that. So, you know, if I really feel like it at this party, I engage in gay sex. But if I really feel like it in this party, I engage in, you know, straight sex or heterosex, whatever you want to call it. And if I'm with this group of people, then I experiment with drugs. If I'm with this group of people, you know, these are sort of my athlete friends. And so people are actually positively engaging and fragmenting their will. And it's thought of today as a good thing because it's free. Only it's not. Because right next to everybody's cheek is this cobra. Here's what happens. The seeker always becomes the sought. Your enemy, the Bible says, like a lion, roams around, hiding behind a bush, just waiting for that person who's seeking to fulfill their fragmented will, and then bam, the seeker is sought. And this is what always happens. This is the basic worldview of the Bible. It's how the people before us took serious things like sin. So the well-ruled heart, then, is somebody who doesn't allow themselves or actually purposely pursue fragmentation, but the well-ruled heart is somebody who says, I want to match my will to God's. And so I'm going to abandon myself to him. And that the view of the Bible is that that then brings contentment and participation in God's will. And, you know, it's kind of straight to ask here, then what does that mean? We lose our will? Do we become less of a person? And no, it actually means the opposite. That we actually become a functional will, where we're no longer at war in ourselves or with ourselves or at war with others. And then, of course, that begs the question, well, how do you do that? And the answer is you apprentice yourself to Jesus. Now, here's the good news that comes from our readings this morning, and we'll conclude with this. The good news is that it's the heart, the will, the spirit that God hears and interacts with. Can these bones live? Can my fragmented, intentionally fragmented heart be made well? Yes, these bones can live. They can emerge from their grain and live. Or think of our reading in Romans. I love the way Gene gets it in the Message. It stands to reason, doesn't it, that if the alive and present God who raised Jesus from the dead moves into your life, he'll do the same thing in you that he did in Jesus. He'll bring you alive with himself. I don't remember if it was last week or the week before we read the story of the man born blind in John 9. And I told you that while that healing was true, it actually happened. It also had a sign showing people, signifying something that was true even above and beyond the healing itself. And the same thing is here with the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Yes, Lazarus really was raised from the dead. But what Jesus says to the ladies is the important bit. You don't have to wait for the end. I am right now the resurrection and the life. Remember, Martha was saying, well, yeah, Lord, I know that, you know, in the end, the resurrection will come. And Jesus says, no, you don't get it. You don't have to wait for the end. Right now, I can tame your unruly souls. The present that every thoughtful Jew was, sorry, the future that every thoughtful Jew was waiting to happen had come into the present. That's what Jesus was saying. And he's come into our present. He's come into your present. And will come into fractured, unruly wills, disordered desires, sinful affections that are out of control. Right now, Jesus says, I can come there and I can make those bones live. I can take what is the spirit of the flesh and I can give you the spirit of God's spirit. And you don't have to wait for the end. I am right now the resurrection and the life. So that the one who believes in me, even though she or he dies, will live. Everyone who lives believing in me does not ultimately die at all. Now I want to take our last minute here. I told you that I would point you at the end towards this more positive idea of being held hard and fast, our hearts being fixed to, if you look at that collect, fixed to and loving what God commands. Well, again, can this really happen? Can these bones live? Can this heart be ruled? You know, think of our psalm, help God, the bottom's fallen out. You know, think of Paul, I have the mind of flesh. Think of Lazarus, you know, parts of me, Lord, feel 4 days dead. And Jesus weeps. If I had a big whiteboard and I put capital G-O-D, God. You want to know what that word means? Jesus weeps. That's what that word means. God is in solidarity with his broken creation. And at Lent, when we pause, stop, and you find an unruly will, and you find sinful affections, and you find dry bones, and like the psalmist, you say, Lord, I don't know what I can do. Jesus weeps, meaning Jesus is in solidarity with his broken world. He gets it. He gets the world's pain. He gets what's going on. And he so values our wills and our personhood that he's willing to come to it and heal it, rise it from the dead. As the psalmist said, thank God God's not an accountant. If he was, who could stand a chance? This is a Hunter paraphrase. As it turns out, you're a philanthropist. As it turns out, you love the human condition and you love human people. So in Lent, we say, I'm waiting and I'm watching. And as the psalmist said, with God's arrival comes love. With God's arrival comes loving kindness and generous redemption. No doubt about it. Let me say that again. That's the last line of the psalm. So, Lord, I'm waiting, I'm watching. And with God's arrival comes love. With God's arrival comes loving kindness and generous redemption. No doubt about it.